Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
I'm going to tell you how it's going to be. You'll be listening to us three and have a lot of fun tonight. I've always been fascinated by these short periods of time that started a long-lasting renaissance and what influenced the person or group, or did the idea start the cultural creativity for that time period. There's a little bit of both. What was the lasting legacy? 1959 was one of those moments in American history, and several of the Nightlight guests have connections to that possibly overlooked renaissance. Let me just run a few of these examples by like Greg Martin from the Kentucky Headhunters recorded recorded a CD with Johnny Johnson, Chuck Berry's piano player. Arlen Roth has Steve Cropper and Albert Lee on his Telemaster CD. Both will be playing at the Buddy Holly 85th birthday concert this Saturday in Lubbock, Texas. Bassist Eddie Denise also plays bass for Dion DiMucci, who was on the Winter Dance Party tour. Merle Fankhauser has done West Coast tours with Jan and Dean. They did a Southern California tour with Richie Valens, and Richie's brother Mario is to be at the Buddy Holly birthday concert. Arlen worked with Don McLean of American Pie fame, which covers much of tonight's show. Arlen recorded with Dwayne Eddy, no relation to me. Dwayne is hosting the birthday concert. Elvis's pianist, Glenn D. Harden, worked with Albert Lee on Emmylou Harris's Luxury Liner, and Arlen recorded with James Burton, Elvis's guitarist. A couple of the Crickets appear on Clapton's first solo CD, and Clapton has done a lot of recordings and performances with Albert, and Albert played at the concert for George, which brings us back to the Beatles and Crickets. And so when we get into that, And I'm sure I'm missing several other ones, but you know, it's just fascinating to see all these connections. And you know, when I had a chance to, the second time I met Albert 3 years ago, you know, he realized I was working with Arlen and spent, you know, a little bit more time with me than, you know, than some of the other people who were, you know, trying to get autographs. And you know, I'm just deeply appreciative of, you know, someone of his stature, you know, taking some time out for me. And I just create, like, you know, those concert stories. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, met this person, and you know, things like that. You know, little things like that just create lifelong fans for him. And you know, probably somewhere in the second part of the show, you know, we'll be talking about another momentous event that happened in 1959, the Twilight Zone premiered, and we've had Mike Pfeiffer, Mark Olshaker, Bill Mumy, and Serling as guests, and you know, they've met Rod. So, sorry about needing a flow chart for that introduction, but it's just really, I've just been really amazed by the connections Nightlight has had to history. And so if you want to learn more about the Buddy Holly 85th birthday concert, you can go to buddyhollyhall.com. And you know, for the Serling Fest 22, you can go to rodserling.com. We have lots of listeners in Austin, Texas, so head over to the concert. It's kind of a far drive, but I'm going to support a fellow Texan. So anyhow, we have Gary Clevenger, who has written extensively on Buddy Holly and the Crickets, and the Crickets were a legendary band on their own. He's been a fixture at the Serling Fest as well. And our other Buddy Holly and Rod Serling Twilight Zone scholar is Ryan Vandergriff. And he has several books documenting the Winter Dance Party and the Mysteries of Flanders Field. Hi, guys. How you doing?
Doing good. How about yourself?
Oh, hey, I'm fine. I hope I didn't lose all the listeners with that intro, but I'm just kind of amazed by all these connections to this time period. And maybe we should start with Buddy's background. Gary, do you want to talk a little bit about his background? And you know, just I think with both of our themes tonight, Buddy and Rod, we can look at you know, the creative process, but you know, we'll just focus on Buddy right now. How did he grow up and basically change the world?
Well, Buddy grew up with a family that loved him, and actually, as he got older and began to show his musical talent, his family really supported him 100% of the way. So, I was just sitting here thinking about a few minutes ago that there was, you know, you're asking me about his interest in music, and I'm thinking back to one of the documentaries on his life, and that basically said that, you know, in the early 50s and that there wasn't a lot to do. So, you know, everybody at one point would either sing and they'd pick up a guitar or learn how to play the piano or whatever, you know. And I would say the first thing that really was, like I said, Buddy grew up in a musical family, you know. So there was a talent contest, and his two brothers were playing in the talent contest. And Buddy wanted to play along with them. But Larry and Travis, Buddy's brothers, they thought, well, you know, we'll let him come up on stage, and we're going to put oil on his bow. So when he hits the strings, you won't hear anything. So they performed a song called Sailing Down the River of Memories. And the talent contest, there was a $5 prize that night. And even though Buddy could not make any noise from the instrument that he was playing, they won the $5 contest. So, and then after that, just pretty much just his interest took off from there.
Okay. And from some of the, you know, videos, you know, you have a very informative book, you know, The Crickets, Six Decades of Rock and Roll Memories. And, you know, you do have a lot of biographical material in that book as well. But, I was watching a lot of videos, you know, just YouTube videos to prepare for the show, and he was one video had somewhat, I think it was the pastor of the church, and I assume the church is still standing.
I believe that's the Tabernacle. I believe it's the Tabernacle Church. Is that right, Gary?
That's Tabernacle, yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And he was singing in the church choir. Family was involved with the church, you know, very closely.
Yes. Both brothers, Larry and Travis, were deacons in the church, and the family did attend church regularly, you know, almost like probably every other person did back in those days. You know, Sunday, it was the day you went to church. So, you know, there was all kinds of things that, you know, I would say probably helped Buddy hone his sound, you know, singing with his family and, you know, singing in the church and, you know, the friends would get together and they would, you know, try to come up with songs or whatever. And, you know, there was just always music was all around. If you weren't playing it, somebody else was. So, you know, and if you didn't know how to play, there was somebody willing there to probably teach you. So, music was pretty prevalent around that time.
Okay, and Ryan, when was the band Buddy's like first bands formed, and you know, were kind of building up to the Crickets? What's that story?
Well, you know, Holly gigged around Lubbock for, you know, quite a while with a lot of, you know, amazing musicians like Jack Neal and Bob Montgomery and, of course, Sonny Curtis. You know, and over time, you know, you know, these guys, they would, you know, they would form, you know, these sort of de facto bands, and they became quite well known throughout Lubbock. I mean, and there were different bands. There was Buddy and Bob, of course, which was Buddy Holly and his childhood friend Bob Montgomery. I mean, you know, and it was all kind of building up to the Crickets. And it's funny, the one constant was always Buddy Holly. You know, there's sort of this this focal point, you know, of this, you know, musical fraternity, if you will, and you know. Musicians came and went, but Holly was always the constant, and it was always building up, it felt like, to the Crickets. It was, I don't know how, you know, certain things happen, but there are these perfect marriages. You know, certain musicians come together, and if ever there was a quartet beginning, which would be Buddy Holly, you know, Jerry Allison, Joe B. Malden, and Nicky Sullivan, I mean, these guys came together and formed such an amazing sound. It really, you know, it sort of set the precedent for, you know, all these other musicians to follow. And it's boggling to think how young these guys were when they started out, you know. It just, to this day, it really just flabbergasts me.
How old were they at this time?
You can jump in here and help me here, Gary. I know that obviously they started off, I mean, I know Holly, there's some recordings of Holly when he was just 13 years old on acetate. So he started off very early. I'm thinking, you know, 13, 14. Would that be about right, Gary?
Junior high.
And actually, speaking of that, you know, just talking a few minutes ago, it got me to thinking that it was probably about 10 years ago or so, and they are on YouTube if you want to listen to them, and I know they've been released on CD, but, you know, they're always looking for, you know, the lost Buddy Holly tape, or, you know, it's got to be around somewhere, the recordings we haven't heard. But about 10 years ago, there were two songs that were Buddy and Jack, which would have been Buddy Holly and Jack Neal, and the two songs, I Saw the Moon Crying Last Night, and I Hear the Lord Calling for Me. So like I said, if you have any interest or your listeners have any interest, they can check out those songs on YouTube. They are actually really quite good, and they really do have good sound quality. So, yeah, something to check out. But like Ryan was saying, you know, they started out pretty young. The earliest recordings was like around 13, 14 years old, you know. And, I was going to say something, forgot what I was going to say. Jerry Allison was the closest in age to Buddy. He was like, if I remember correctly, like, 1 or 2 years younger than Buddy. So, yeah, they were all very young. And like I said, their careers didn't last very long, but what they accomplished in that short period of time, nobody could do that. Nobody could do that today.
And if I could jump in real fast just touch upon something that Gary said in passing about Jerry Allison. I think Gary joins me in saying that Jerry Allison and Buddy Holly were kind of the Lennon-McCartney of the 1950s. Jerry Allison wasn't just Buddy's sideman. They were real partners in every sense. They wrote together. They played together. I mean, you cannot, in my opinion, you just can't understate the importance of Jerry Allison to the Buddy Holly story. Without one, you don't have the other, right?
That's 100% correct, because, like I said, in everything that I've heard, you know, Jerry knew what Buddy was going to play before Buddy played it. So he knew, you know, that they had played together for so long, they knew what each other needed. So, and like I said, Ryan's 100% correct on that one. So,
where did the name The Crickets come from?
You take that one, Gary. It's a great story.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty good story. You know, they were they were thinking about a name for the band, and they were thinking, well, you know, we'll come up with an insect name. And so they're sitting there through the dictionary, and they came across spiders. And there was a record that was put out by a group called the Spiders. It's called Witchcraft, which, if your listeners aren't familiar with that, that's also on YouTube. And there's a there's a beat in that song that is the same beat that Jerry Allison decided he was going to replicate for Peggy Sue. So, but they decided they were going through. They said, yeah, spiders, no, that's already been used. Then they thought, well, they kept looking around. They saw crickets. And they thought, well, there's a lot of crickets, crickets in Lubbock. Crickets make noise. We'll just call ourselves the Crickets. And then that's how that came about.
Is it? I'm going to jump in. Is it true, Gary? Do you think, or do you think it's just sort of more legend about how at one point Allison, you know, looked at the word Beatles and they momentarily considered that, or do you think that's more? Do you think that's become more of a kind of a legend? Do you think there's any truth to that story, or?
I think there is probably some truth to that, but they decided to go with the Crickets, you know.
That's a perfect choice.
So, you know, and the thing about it is, you know, the Beatles changed it, their name, because they, you know, they really adored the Crickets, and they thought, mm-hmm. well, we can't use Crickets, that's already used. So then they came across Beatles, and they thought, well, B-E-E-T-L-E-S. No, we're not going to do that. Let's make it B-E-A-T for beat. You know, it goes with music, and we'll call ourselves the Beatles. And then that's how that came about.
Yeah. Okay, so you got us to the point where Buddy has a band, and they and you know, I was just watching one of the YouTube videos, and they opened for Elvis, and you could see Elvis walking through the crowd, and there's like Buddy and Jerry Allison, kind of like. You know, shell shock, like, oh my gosh, you know, there's Elvis right there in front of us. So, they seem to have been able to get enough attention to open for, you know, like, you know, the biggest name in music at that time.
Well, but to put that in proper framing, though, at that time, Elvis was very much up and coming. He had an incredible buzz about him. I mean, the industry was, you know, as the industry always is, they're, you know, always talking amongst themselves. But Presley wasn't, quote, Elvis at that point. He was still Elvis Presley, leader of the Blue Moon Boys, I believe. And so he was getting a name for himself, but not so much so where it was improbable that, you know, Holly, you know, could, you know, open for the guy. So, but it was, and that footage you're talking about, my gosh, it's beautiful, it's glorious. If your listeners ever get a chance, definitely jump on YouTube. It's in color, and it's all silent, of course, but it's just a really nice little peek behind the door of rock and roll history.
Yeah, I was just, you know, when they zoomed in on Buddy in the crowd, I was like, oh, there he is. It's like,
it's, yeah, amazing.
It's like two of the huge names of, you know, that time right there in the same room. So let's move on to, you know, the first recordings and, you know, going to Clovis, New Mexico, and meeting with Norman Petty. What is your research revealed about that period in Buddy's life?
Gary, this is your specialty. I'll let you take that one.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's say the one thing about it is Clovis was 90 miles from Lubbock. So, you know, it was a heck of a lot easier to go to Clovis than it was to jump in the car and go to Nashville. So, but of course, Buddy did make a trip to Nashville. We can talk about that in a few minutes. But,
sure.
But the one thing about it is there Norman Petty was a very I'm trying to think of the correct wording here. He was like the Phil Spector of the early 50s. He knew what he needed to do. He knew, you know, when musicians came in there, how the sound should be, and should I move this piece of equipment, or should I move this speaker, should I this? And, you know, he knew everything about mixing. I don't know your viewers will ever have a chance to take a look at this book, but there's a book out there by a gentleman by the name of Frank Blanas, B-L-A-N-A-S. It's called The King of Clovis. And it pretty much goes into the life and times of Norman Petty. And, you know, it talks about some of the techniques that he used with all the people that came through there. Because you got to remember that, you know, Buddy Holly and the Crickets weren't the only ones that came through there. You know, you had Roy Orbison, you had others coming out there too. So, yeah, the Norman Petty studio was the place to go. So, seems like I was going to say something else. I can't think what I was going to say. But the other thing they liked about it, because I'll tell you, I don't know if I'm sure Ryan's made a trip out there. I know I made a trip out there. But one of the things the guys enjoyed is that Norman never charged by the hour for the recordings or for per session. You know, if it took you 20 minutes to do a recording, fine. If it took you 2 days, that's fine. It was all, you know, that's the way they did it back then. But the one nice thing about the Norman Petty studio, excuse me, I have something in my throat there, but the one nice thing about the Norman Petty studio is not only was it a studio, it was a functional home. So if you were recording and you decided, well, I want to go get something to drink or a sandwich, or I want to lay down for a little bit, you know, you didn't have to get in your car and, you know, fly all the way back to Lubbock and then come back to Clovis. You could just stop recording and go lay down, rest, whatever. Matter of fact, there are one photo that I'm for sure of that I've seen was taken of Buddy at the Norman Petty studio, and he was sitting on a couch with his head back trying to catch a few winks. So... So that's a pretty nice photo. But,
Gary, in your book, you do have an interview, reprinted interview of Norman. You know, there is information in there about how he was very encouraging for Buddy to experiment.
Well, I'll have to agree with you on that too. You know, Norman wasn't set in stone. You know, just like Buddy, if Buddy had an idea and he thought something would work, Norman would say, go ahead and try it. And if it worked, it worked. If it didn't, they would try something else. But, you know, like on the recording Peggy Sue, they were recording it and the drums were so loud that they couldn't get the right mix on the recording. So they had to move the drums into another room. So J.I. Allison could play the drums on the recording, so, and for everything to come out fine, so. But they always made sure that no matter how long it took, they got the right sound.
Okay, so since we're talking about J.I. and his drumming, there's also the, was it like spanking his knees or thighs for every day? Was that one of Norman's ideas or was it done at his studio?
I know Gary is going to correct me if I'm wrong here. Wasn't it an ideal that then Buddy actually hear J.I. slapping his hands against his Levi's and thought that sound was like really kind of catchy and maybe appropriate, and they suggested that they kind of try a cut with that? Is that right, Gary? Or
well, yep, that's 100% right. So you know, Buddy was always listening to things. So you know, if he heard something, he thought, well, we'll try it. Like on the song "Not Fade Away," you know, they used a cardboard box because Buddy at that point thought that using the box would create a better sound than using the drum kit. So, and as you can tell, it was a lot clearer sound. And there's a lot of musicians that have gone on to say that they said, you know what, J.I. Allison playing on that box was a sound that we were trying to get all along. So, you know, that's been you know, things like that, a little different nuances have been used on different songs throughout history, so.
Okay, and Gary, you talk about the, what's that xylophone type instrument on every day?
So it's called a celeste. So I know there's some people that have argued this of who was playing the celeste on every day, and I will tell you that I'm 99.999% sure that it was Vi Petty, Norman Petty's wife. So, matter of fact, there's a DVD that's out, The Real Buddy Holly Story, which was produced by Paul McCartney, that has Vi Petty playing the celeste. So, like I said, when the movie that came out, The Buddy Holly Story with Gary Busey, I'm kind of maybe jumping a little bit ahead of myself here, so just tell me if I am. But like I said, the movie I was just talking about, The Real Buddy Holly Story, that was produced by Paul McCartney, was when the movie that had Gary Busey in it, the Buddy Holly Story, came out. You know, it was definitely a good movie, entertaining, filled with a lot of inaccuracies. And so Paul McCartney decided that he wanted to make a movie that would set the record straight. So The Real Buddy Holly Story is a documentary that's got his brothers and J.I. Allison and Joe B. Malden and others that are talking about what it was like growing up and getting into the music, and Buddy's brothers talking about their relationship with Buddy. So, like I said, I might be getting a little bit ahead of myself at this point, but it's a real good movie.
And if I can just echo what Gary said about The Real Buddy Holly Story and maybe put a sort of a personal spin on it too, if I may. The Real Buddy Holly Story was one of the very first things that really stoked, you know, my passion for learning about that final period of Buddy's life, January and early February of 59, there's a segment towards the end of that doc where Tommy Alsup is being interviewed, and Tommy played for Buddy on the Winter Dance Party tour. And I as a young teenager, I studied that segment of film over and over again, like it was the Shroud of Turin or something. And there were some great photos that flashed throughout that little section that were taken from the Green Bay, Wisconsin show on February the 1st of 59, taken by a photographer named Larry Maddy. And beautiful color photos, probably the best of that tour. That documentary really was instrumental in stoking my passion for Buddy Holly, and specifically the Winter Dance Party tour.
Well, I definitely have to agree with Ryan on that too. You know, when the movie first came out, I'll tell you what, I remember renting it as on VHS at Blockbuster. So, it shows you how long ago that was. But I finally did add it to my collection on DVD, and it is really a good movie. And if anybody wants to really learn more about Buddy, there are a lot of DVDs out there, but I do agree with Ryan. I would suggest trying to locate yourself a copy of the real Buddy Holly story, because I think it's the best documentary out there. But then again, that's just me, so.
I fully endorse that view, Gary.
Well, thank you.
Mutual Admiration Society.
But it's, you know, when I listen to the very best of Buddy Holly and the Crickets, it has, you know, like about 50 songs on it. The lyrics seem, you know, simplistic for the time. They're also, you know, being written by a, 20, 21-year-old. But there is still a maturity to the writing.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan or Gary, do you hear that as well, or, you know, do you have a different take on it?
My take is, no, you're absolutely, you know, I mean, Holly, you know, he wrote for his audience, and his audience at that time, you know, he had a good sense for kind of what was in the zeitgeist of teenage existence, and that was usually, you know, going to parties, getting grounded, borrowing the car from mom and dad, that sort of thing. And he wrote to that,
yeah.
But he always put his own little unique flair to that. And with a lot of his earlier recordings, especially, it's really not so much about the words, but it's kind of more, for me at least personally, about the fill-in that he puts behind those words. He's able to convey something that almost transcends, you know, some of the words that he wrote. And I'll be doggone, I've not seen many other artists, you know, before or since, that have been able to pull that, you know, little magic trick off.
Gary.
Just to kind of piggyback what Ryan was saying, you know, I don't know if I should mention by name, but I know there are a couple of very famous musicians that have said, you know, that they liked listening to the lyrics of Buddy Holly songs because they were direct and to the point. They weren't complicated. You didn't have to figure what they were saying. You know, you knew what he was saying, but say it in 2 minutes or less. And as far as the actual playing of the music, I'm sure there's plenty of people in the United States, but during Buddy's UK tour, there were musicians that have said that the songs didn't seem complicated to play. And just starting out as musicians at that point, they thought, well, this is probably something I could play. And so then, you know, they would sit down with their guitars and they would try to, you know, to play That'll Be the Day or Peggy Sue, and, you know, and they were able to do it. And the other thing about it is, you know, that Buddy and the Crickets started something that the rest of rock and roll picked up on, whether consciously or unconsciously, you know, that there was four guys up on stage. They all wrote their own music. You know, they didn't have to worry about somebody from the outside saying, okay, here's a song, and go out and play it. They were writing their own songs, so they had their own little contained group. They were writing their own songs. It was perfect. And like I said, you know, going forward, you know, there's lots of groups that have copied that. You know, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, which, by the way, when the Beatles started in their Quarrymen days, their first acetate was That'll Be the Day. And the Rolling Stones, their first big release was Not Fade Away. So, I mean, I think that's a real good tribute to their love for Buddy Holly and the music that their first songs were Buddy Holly songs. So, excuse me.
You know, when we've had, you know, Gary made some good points, and you know, when you know we've done. Probably the best example is when we were doing the Shakespeare authorship controversy last year, and you know, one of the books I read to prep for the show was Shakespeare Identified, and J. Thomas Sweeney was talking about how if Shakespeare was writing those really intricate sonnets at 34, at the age of 34, it really doesn't seem appropriate for someone his age to be writing on the maturity level of someone in his 50s. And once you reach, you know, like that age, that's where you've had enough life experiences and immaturity to deal with situations. You're not flying off the handle. Looney was making the point that, a lot of younger people, don't have the maturity to write these worldwide masterpieces, but there are exceptions, and it just seems after reading Gary's book, and then I'm starting to listen more closely to the Buddy Holly CD. Maybe Buddy is actually an exception to that rule.
Well, I'm going to have to agree with you, and hopefully I'm not interrupting you when I say this, but I know the very first time I ever went to the Surf Ballroom was in 2009, and there was a very famous playwright there, and I'm not going to mention his name because I don't don't really want to do that on the podcast. But you know, he made the comment. He said, you know, just to think that Buddy wrote all those beautiful songs and died when he was 22, George Gershwin would have been proud. And that was one of those mind-blown moments to actually compare Buddy Holly to George Gershwin. But, you know, look at all the masterpieces that the Gershwin brothers recorded and, you know, how young they were. So, you know, it's really interesting when you think back, you know, at a lot of the people that were really young and they either wrote songs or wrote books or whatever the case may be, and we lost them at a really early age, you know, and I just find that mind-boggling sometimes that, you know, that they were able to accomplish all they accomplished in a short period of time. And sometimes you look at some people today and it'll take them an entire lifetime to accomplish what they did maybe in 2 years or so. So
I'm falling into that category. Takes a lifetime. what we've just been talking about is an interest of mine is the creative process. It really is interesting. You get 12 years later, Jim Morrison had almost Jimi Hendrix would be a contemporary where most of everything we knew that those two recorded was just in a about 4 year time period.
Right.
I just find it really fascinating. Like, you know, like what I was talking about with the maturity level of older people, but sometimes you get, you know, the few examples of younger people who really made a difference. I just think a lot about that.
Sure, and you know what's fascinating is Buddy Holly's career when he passed away, still very embryonic. He was still developing. He was still growing as an artist.
Yeah.
And we know that just from some of the music he left behind that he recorded in his apartment in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great bluesy number he cut called That Makes It Tough. Oh my golly. Gary can probably vouch for this. It's just this wonderful piece of soul music from Buddy Holly. It's just startling. It's fascinating to think what he might have done with that practice tape if he had come back from that Winter Dance Party tour.
Gary, you mentioned the tape, recordings he just did with his little tape recorder in his apartment in New York. You have a little section on that.
Yeah, like I said, it was believe six songs that he had recorded on the little reel-to-reel recorder he had in his house, and those are also on YouTube, and they've got not only the songs, but, you know, Buddy and Maria talking, and, you know, just a lot of going back and trying the song again because Buddy might have hit the wrong string or the wrong chord and he maybe wanted to change it to a different chord or something. But yeah, those are beautiful. And it just got me to thinking that I believe there is and I keep talking about YouTube, but you can get this stuff on CD and stuff if you look hard enough. Matter of fact, there's a great site in the UK called Roller Coaster Records, and that's where you can find a lot of the rare stuff. But it just got me to thinking that there was a group called the David Hanson Combo, and they took the song, some of the Apartment songs from Buddy, and you know, they cleaned them up a little bit, and they added you know, some brand new orchestration and things to those recordings. And though, I mean, I like the stuff that Buddy recorded in New York without, you know, all the overdubbing and everything, but these recordings I'm talking about with the David Hanson Combo, they're beautiful. I mean, it's for what they tried to accomplish, they're beautiful. So, but it just shows you the scope of, you know, you can take a good song, and it's really difficult to make it bad, but I'm sure there's somebody out there that could do it. But, you know, these songs almost have like a life of their own, so.
Gary, you just mentioned the string section. You know, look at, you know, just for example, It Doesn't Matter Anymore. I think that has a string section. Was Norman suggesting something like, you know, why don't you have, you know, like, a, you know, the string section for, you know, for this track, or is that Buddy's original idea?
Well, like I said, Ryan can come in on this one too, but in my honest opinion, that was all Buddy's idea. You know, Buddy loved playing the rock and roll because that's where the bread and butter was at. But you know, Buddy wanted to get into playing. He really wanted to do the strings. So that was really his thing. He wanted to, you know, to try it out and see what it would sound like. You know, and I got to thinking about this probably a couple of years ago. You know, if Buddy would have never had the idea to do strings, you know, and those recordings came out beautiful, you know, at the Pit, you know, that they recorded at the Pythian Temple, you know, just think of some of the groups we wouldn't have today. You wouldn't have ELO, or you wouldn't have Emerson, Lake and Palmer, or groups like Yes, you know, some of the more progressive groups that were out there during the 70s, you know. So, yeah, kudos to Buddy on that.
That's a good point.
So anyways, I was going to say something else. I can't think what I was going to say, so...
I'll say this. You mentioned It Doesn't Matter Anymore. And there's two camps of Buddy Holly fans. There's the camp that just absolutely, they're very very fanatical about the rockabilly phase of Holly's career. And they're a little, maybe a little more wary about the string stuff. You know, there's this perception that maybe Holly was trying to segue out of rock and roll. But, you know, the older I get, the more I have to say, I think It Doesn't Matter Anymore. It's probably my all-time favorite Buddy Holly song. I'll probably be castigated and burned in effigy for publicly saying that. And it's not even Buddy's song. It was written for him by Mr. Paul Anka, who I believe the two of them were about to engage in a writing partnership with one another after that Winter Games Party tour. So, yeah, no... Yeah, the string stuff, as I get older, I don't know, maybe my tastes are changing. I don't know what's happening, but I'm a pretty big aficionado of that stuff. I wish maybe some outtakes or stuff like that might pop up one day. Although, from what I understand, Buddy nailed It Doesn't Matter Anymore, I think, in one take. So that rules out that.
Yeah. And kind of piggybacking on what Ryan was saying just a few minutes ago, during those sessions at Pythian Temple, you know, they had a set list of the songs that they were going to perform there. And and the song It Doesn't Matter Anymore, that they didn't think they could work it in. You know, so Buddy got with Dick Jacobs, And, you know, he told Dick Jacobs, he said, I have to do this song. I just have to do this song. We have to work it into the session. And they did work it into the session. And, you know, so with the help of Dick Jacobs' arrangements and things. And and like Ryan just said, you know, nailed it in one take. And if you do listen to that song, I'm not trying to compare it to any other song, but as far as a song that's out there that is as timeless as It Doesn't Matter Anymore, this might sound weird, but I put it right up there with Somewhere Over the Rainbow, because those two songs, for some reason, seem to go, in a weird way, seem to go so well together, and they're both timeless, and they're never going anywhere. They're here forever.
Very true, and a little Trivial Pursuit moment here. It Doesn't Matter Anymore posthumously peaked for Holly at number 13, and it was he was promoting it while he was on the Winter Dance Party tour. I've always maintained if Holly had lived, that song would have been a number one hit. I really feel like the studio, I just feel like his label didn't really know how to push the song. They kind of floundered after his passing. And but yeah, it's just, again, I love that song so much.
Okay. Yeah, it is a very a moving song. So, you know, we have to get to Buddy and the Crickets' appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show and the importance of the tour of the UK, and yeah, we have a lot of UK listeners. I'm sure that they will, you know, find this part interesting. Gary, do you want to talk about one or the other?
Whichever one. Well, I guess I could talk about the UK tour.
Okay.
You know.
The Trocadero.
Yeah. So what happened in the UK was that they had gone on a it was a show that was hosted by Des O'Connor, and it was like a variety show. It had the Tanner Sisters and a few other acts, and Buddy Holly and the Crickets was the rock and roll act. It was there for the kids, but like I said, it was a variety show, and everybody went out and did their, the two or three songs or whatever, and then the next act came out, and, there's also, speaking of the UK tour, and once again, I'm going to go back to the YouTube thing, there is a great show that's hosted by Jeff Barker, that's called Buddy in Britain, and that's just got some incredible interviews with people that that were either in the audience of the UK tours, or they were actually with the tour with Des O'Connor. So that's about all I had at this point.
I'll throw in another book suggestion. There's a great book on by a fellow named Jim Carr, who used to run a Holly fanzine called, appropriately enough, Holly International. He wrote a great book about Buddy's UK tour also. It's about as rare as hen's teeth, so you'll have to really scour eBay on a regular basis to find it, but it's well worth your time tracking down if you want to know more about that UK tour.
Right. And there's also a couple of books by another UK author, Spencer Lay, that talks about Buddy and the UK tour, and you know, and those are both good books to try to see if you can find too. By, like I said, the author again, his name is Spencer Lay, L-E-I-G-H. So
okay, so I know it might have been, I know it was definitely the second time I saw Albert Lee playing. He's talking about he wanted to go to the Trocadero in March of 1958, and he was there on the wrong day, and about 15 years later, he ends up working with the Crickets for a couple years. But Albert still plays songs, and some of his favorite Buddy songs, like Rock Around with Ollie V. Are still, classic rockabilly song. But it seems like there must have been a lot of British kids who really got a great taste of American music on that tour. What was the impact of like the 3 weeks that they spent in England and the TV appearances?
Well, the one thing about the appearing live in TV appearances is that, you know, they were always on the go. There wasn't much time for, you know, just a whole lot of leisure.
Sightseeing
and that kind of thing. So, you know, they might be on a television program, and then they're off to do a show, and then they're, after they leave that show, they're on their way to another show. So, you know, I was going to say the influence on a lot of the British musicians, like I said, once again, I'm not going to mention any person's name or on the podcast, but there's one very famous musician that said, you know, that seeing Buddy Holly and the Crickets, you know, all they did is that they took the sound they were hearing, repackaged it into their own songs, and gave it back to us via the British invasion. So,
well said.
There, like I said, there's also another very famous British musician who said, you know, that he was very surprised by the sound that was coming out of this small little amp and Buddy's guitar. And you know, they were just blown away at what Buddy was able to do, the sound he was able to make to come out of this small little, you know, they carried on this speaker onto the stage, and you know, and then prior to that, they might have had an orchestra playing, and Buddy and the Crickets were able to somehow match that sound level. So, and then, like I said, there was a lot of the younger people in the audience that were surprised that they were able to that Buddy and the Crickets were able to reach that level of sound with just that small little speaker and his guitar.
Okay, five years or so before the Beatles made their appearance on Ed Sullivan, Buddy Holly and the Crickets were on the Ed Sullivan Show. What do you think of that performance, and what some of your research into that prestigious show revealed to you about the having a prime time exposure?
You know, that Sullivan show in the 1950s was the Cadillac of variety shows. If you're an up-and-coming rock and roll act, you can't beat the free publicity a spot on the Sullivan show gets you. And Holly and the Crickets appeared on the Sullivan show twice, once in late 57, second time in early 58. The first time, you know, went off pretty well. They performed Peggy Sue and That'll Be the Day, both of them which were really high in the charts for them at the time. And it's interesting, by the time Holly and the Boys appeared on the Sullivan Show in early 58, if you go back, and again, to echo Gary, with go to YouTube, the Sullivan clips with Holly are, I'm sure, are probably plastered all over that site. But the difference in stage appearance for Holly, Allison, Malden, and Sullivan, although Sullivan was gone by the time of the second appearance, the stage appearance of those group of boys from the first show to the second, markedly different. They had gone Ivy League by the second appearance and looked very polished. They were hanging out with the Everly Brothers by that point. And I think they were all hanging out down in the village at, you know, at the clothing shops and spending a lot of money like, you know, any kid would do in New York City at that time. But the second appearance was a little shakier for the Crickets than the first. There was a problem with the timing of the Crickets showing up. Apparently Sullivan was ready to cue the Crickets at one point, and Holly was there, and J.I. and Joe B. were nowhere to be found. And by the time they corralled them, you know, word around campfire is that Holly had kind of rubbed Sullivan the wrong way. And you look at that clip of that second appearance, Holly's performing Oh Boy, and the lighting is just a little shadier than that first appearance. The camera seems a little shakier. It seems deliberately, I'm not going to say it was, you know, deliberate sabotage, but you kind of wonder. And anyways, and I've never been able to determine if it's urban legend or fact, but I believe Jerry Allison actually said that Holly was approached to appear on Sullivan a third time in late 58. And I think by that point, Holly had just kind of had his fill of Ed Sullivan, at least for that period of time, and actually apparently turned down an appearance. So yeah, that's kind of Buddy's tumultuous history with Mr. Ed Sullivan.
And once again, to kind of piggyback what Ryan was saying that second time around, you know, that that Buddy and J.I. and Joe B., I guess I miffed Ed Sullivan off because, you know, J.I. and Joe B. were nowhere to be found, that when it came time for them to go on the stage, Ed Sullivan introduced them as Buddy Hollard and his Cricket. So it wasn't Buddy Holly and the Crickets. He said Buddy Hollard and his Crick Cuts. So
and maybe you can – and what have you heard, Gary, about – from what I understand, originally the Crickets were supposed to perform two songs on that second appearance. And I guess because of the tardiness of the Crickets, it got struck down to one. Do you know anything about that or –
Well, yeah, it did get struck down to one, and it was all just a timing issue. And actually, Ed was trying to cut the first song a little bit short, so Buddy made sure that he just played the whole thing a little bit faster. And if you look at the clips on YouTube, you can see him, his hand is moving like a lightning bolt.
he's really working it, yeah. Yeah,
just to finish the song, but... And then he lets out, which, you know, this is just my speculation. So, you know, Buddy let out a howl. when he was speeding up playing the guitar, trying to get the rest of the song finished. So I'm sure that probably didn't make Ed happy either. But
okay.
Once again, if anybody wants to see, like I said, either the first appearance or the second appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show, they are there on YouTube.
Yeah, it's really surprising about the number of related videos on YouTube, and the number of young people interested in the topic as well. I thought was surprised. Refreshing as well.
Well, like I said, I said earlier that, good songs just remain timeless. It doesn't matter whether they came out in 1959 or 2009. If it's a good song, it's going to stand the test of time. So, and kind of speaking of that a little bit, of course, not a Buddy Holly song, but a song that has stood the test of time, American Pie by Don McLean. So, and I was actually talking to Ryan about this last week, I think. But on Paramount Plus, there is a documentary about American Pie and its legacy of that it's lasted 50 years. So that's something else that's, if your listeners are interested in that, they may want to check that out. But it's a real good song because Don McLean explained the lyrics in the song and things that people thought all along was not correct. It's not what he was trying to convey. So there's it's actually a good documentary, and it clears up a lot of things that people may have thought over the years that were either incorrect or not 100% correct.
Okay, and I still want to leave some time for Rod Serling. I think we've had such a terrific discussion. We don't need to get into the very end, but both of you have mentioned going to the Surf Ballroom. And that's from one of the videos I saw. That looks like beautiful museum. The dance floor and state. They've done a remarkable job of maintaining the sacredness of that destination as a museum.
Absolutely, and to quote the late Bill Griggs, the Surf Ballroom is a time machine. You step through those doors, and you are transported back to a very close approximation of what it must have been like in 1959. Going to see the Winter Dance Party tour there on February the 2nd of 59. It's truly a remarkable, and as you said, it's almost spot on to what it looked like in 59. I think the only difference is they've widened the stage out a little bit, so it's not the stage isn't the same size, but they do have the original diameters of the stage kind of taped off, so you can kind of get a sense when you're in there about the size of the original stage.
And also, too, if you do have an opportunity to walk in there, like I said, it's, there's pictures on the wall, signed photographs of everybody that's played there, from the big band days of the 30s all the way up to the present time. So And it's definitely a nice venue, so you can kind of get an idea of what it might have felt like on February 2nd, 1959. So,
and let me tell you, Mark, I've been to some of the other surviving ballrooms and theaters and armories that hosted the Winter Dance Party in 59, and none of them look as well maintained as the Surf Ballroom. They've done a remarkable job. They truly have.
Yeah, I thought it was a marvel when I was watching one of the videos last night. People took their camera all through it, and I don't know. Next time, the first time I'll be in Iowa, but I would definitely put that on the top of my list to go there. I was just very, very impressed with the quality of maintaining the atmosphere there. It looks like just a wonderful place to visit. But
it really is. It's holy ground for rock and roll fans.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'd like to go there at some point. Ron, we're talking about doing a show later. Focuses on your books on the Winter Dance Party and in Flanders Field. We can come back to that on another date. I just want to keep things moving ahead with so many positive topics. But Gary, a lot of your, the Cricket Six Decades of Rock and Roll Memories, Jerry Allison and Waylon Jennings, all these people, Albert Lee, all these people that, we've mentioned, had a very lengthy career. They persevered after traumatic event that probably would have caused everyone just to split up. Gary, what was how did the rest of the band stay together for that many years and really contribute a lot of material to pop culture? I did not realize that Sonny Curtis wrote the Mary Tyler Moore theme song.
Yes, he did. And Sonny Curtis has won so many awards for his songwriting, but he was also responsible for writing the song "I Fought the Law."
Yep,
which was a big Bobby Fuller song, Bobby Fuller Four, and of course More Than I Can Say, which has been covered by everybody from Bobby V to Leo Sayer. So, after Buddy died, the band was without their leader. They weren't quite for sure what they were going to do. They knew they loved music. They wanted a career in music, I would think. But they didn't know what to do because Buddy wasn't there. So, like I said, at one point, prior to Buddy's death, they had kind of gone their separate ways for a little bit. But supposedly Jerry Allison was trying to get a hold of Buddy at the Surf Ballroom. He didn't have any luck because he had finally decided that they wanted to, that him and Joe B wanted to get back together with him, because at one point Norman convinced him. He said, you know, Buddy's going to New York. Don't go to New York with him. Just stay here, and you know, we'll figure something out. You don't want to get involved in New York because a lot of things going on there. And you know, so at that point, J.I. and Joe B., you know, they kind of they stayed back in Lubbock, and we went to New York, and basically. J.I. and Joe B. said they got tired of not really doing anything, so they wanted to do something. They wanted to get back into doing their music. So, you know, J.I. wanted to get back, call Buddy and say, hey, we're ready to get back together. But that last night they couldn't connect, and, you know, that the rest is history.
Okay, they did not rest on their laurels. They just continued to be very productive people, musicians.
Well, right. Well, like I said, you know... You know, after Buddy had passed away and they decided to get back into the music business, you know, there was a whole host of changes. They needed to have a lead singer. Wasn't quite for sure who to get. And then there was this young man named Earl Sinks, great vocalist. And, you know, then as things progressed, you know, Earl Sinks had left the band and was replaced by Jerry Naylor. And, you know, they went through that phase in the 60s of, you know, becoming, you know, at one point almost like a pop group. You know, they covered a lot of Beatles songs, which every group at that point, if you were anybody, you were covering I Want to Hold Your Hand and She Loves You and Please Please Me. I can't, like I said, I've been a record collector since I was 12 years old, and I can't think of almost any album that I ever bought, from Johnny Rivers to Bobby V to Gary Lewis and the Playboys. Everybody covered a Beatles song. Excuse me, even Jan and Dean, they covered two or three Beatles songs that I'm thinking about right now at the moment. But, you know, and then as things progressed into the 70s, they did some session work. J.I., like I said, not only did work for Eric Clapton, he also did some work on some of the later LPs for Johnny Rivers. And like I said, there was a whole host of members that kind of changed in the 70s. And members would leave the group for one reason or another. There were several members at one point that had passed away, you know, so everything was evolving, you know, not just the group itself, but the music and people's musical taste was changing. So, you know, the Crickets were just like everybody else trying to adapt to the changing landscape, the ever-changing landscape of music, so...
Okay, and Gary, you got to meet the Crickets on about their last ever concert.
Right. The last ever, out of the last three concerts, I was able to attend two of them. The first one I was able to attend was in 2012. And I didn't attend the second one, which was in Pennsylvania, and I live in Indiana. So, I mean, I probably could have gone, but I was unable to go. So then the last one I went to was the Winter Dance Party in 2017. So it was in tribute to Joe B. Malden, who had passed away. It was J.I. Iverson, and it was Sonny Curtis and Albert Lee and Keith Allison and Glenn D. Hardin, Gordon D. Payne, excuse me, and a gentleman by the name of Tony O'Kay, which you might want to do some research on that name, but he also performed on a great CD that's kind of difficult to find. You can still find it, though. It's called Crickets and Their Buddies. So he was there, and that was pretty much that was it for the Crickets. They hung everything up. And to the best of my knowledge, they have retired, and they're enjoying the rest of their lives.
Well, that must have been a great opportunity for you to highlight of your life to meet them.
It was great. I actually, I was almost starstruck meeting them, but. You know, anybody will tell you that if you've ever met J.I. or, excuse me, when Joe B. was alive and Sonny Curtis, you know, they're just down to earth, you know. They're just great guys. Sit there, have a conversation with them, drink a beer. You know, it's nice when you get to meet your rock and roll heroes and they're everything you thought they were going to be, so... Yeah, I was definitely very excited and very happy that I had that opportunity in my life.
Oh, good for you. Okay, let's. You know, since we have only about 30 minutes left, let's switch topics over to the upcoming Sterling Fest in Binghamton, New York, and. Gary, you're working on a book on a lot of the spirituality that was conveyed in the Twilight Zone episodes. What's your working title? You hope to have that out soon.
Well, yeah, the working title at this point is God, Death, Heaven, and Hell in the Twilight Zone. And it's more or less just an examination of, I'd like to say a handful of episodes, but I think I probably got it down to maybe about 40, 45 episodes. And it's just the examination of the content of the episodes and the spirituality and just that kind of thing. So, the one thing I loved about Rod Serling and the Twilight Zone, which of course Rod wasn't the only writer, but the one message I liked about that show was that there was always. Seemed like to answer to a higher power or to a higher calling or something like that. So one thing I loved about Rod's writing, which not only went into the Twilight Zone but into a show later, Night Gallery, is that the good guys usually seem to come out on top and the bad guys usually seem to have a comeuppance. So and that's kind of where I'm heading at with the book.
Okay.
And like I said, the other thing I think I might add with that is that just I'm also adding some like odd little facts here and there that people might find interesting. without giving too much of the book away, there's an episode called To Serve Man. And
okay.
It's,
that's one of the best ones.
Right. It's about the aliens, the Canamets. But one thing I didn't know until I started doing research is that Canamet is a real word. And it comes from a different dialect. And what's really interesting is in this different dialect, the word Canamet means tasty, which, if anybody has seen the episode of Serve Man, is very interesting. And then one other thing, and then like I said, I won't give too much more of the book away, is that there is another episode called Time Enough at Last, where Burgess Meredith plays Henry Bemis. And at the end of the episode, in part of Rod Serling's closing dialogue, he mentions Of Mice and Men and Henry Bemis. Well, in 1939, Burgess Meredith starred in the movie Of Mice and Men. So just a nice little fact there.
Okay. I think that's what we've been doing tonight is tying together a lot of loose ends.
Awesome.
And one of my buddies and occasional co-host, who is listening in from Texas, has said she has learned a lot tonight. Thank you, Ramona, for listening. But
thank you very much.
Ryan, have you noticed, with all your interest in the Twilight Zone and Rod Serling, have you seen some kind of, like, that one incident that sparked Buddy or Rod to become the person that they are known for? One of my interests in tonight's topic is that what creates that the creative spark that is inspiring us over 60 years later.
Right. Serling obviously had an affinity for the underdog. This is evident in so much of his writing, and beautifully so. If ever there was a champion for the everyman, it would definitely be Serling. I think you could maybe kind of make that through line with Holly also. He was sort of the champion for, the everyday teenager, sort of their captain, if you will.
That's appropriate.
It may be a little too tenuous for some, but I can certainly see that sort of that line, that solid line between the two.
Well, like I said, I have to agree with Ryan too, because I think, like with Buddy, I think another connective thing with Buddy and Rod is that they both had these feelings inside of them, and they had to get them out. I think Buddy's feelings were, being this young kid, growing up, starting to become an adult, finally getting, like we were talking about earlier, going out on dates and falling in love and that kind of thing. And Buddy used his music to get that out. Now, like where Rod is concerned, everything that I've ever heard is that Rod really got into the writing aspect of things because of his experiences in the war. So, just like a lot of people, had all these emotions and thoughts and things inside of him, and the only way he could get it out was by writing it down. And, you know, that's how we got some of the great episodes like Quality of Mercy and Purple Testament and King Nine Will Return. You know, it's just, of course, not all the episodes of The Twilight Zone were about, you know, conflict or war or like that. But they were all, a lot of them were morality tales, you know.
Yeah, they were.
You know, where you wanted the good guy to win and you wanted the bad guy to lose, you know.
I also see a real connection between Serlin and Martin Sloan in Walking Distance. You know, I know sort of like, you know, his fictitious time traveler in that season one classic, Serlin, I know would oftentimes return to Binghamton to walk the streets of his youth and kind of reflect, if you will. Rod Serlin and the Twilight Zone are one and the same. Ask me now why none of the various remakes over the years have really resounded, it's because Zone was such had such a personal voice, had Serlin's fingerprints all over it. You couldn't separate one from the other, and that's the brilliance of Rod Serlin.
You know, like I was talking about a few minutes ago, you know, I'm just giving you my feelings on this. You were talking about the episode Walking Distance. Now, when Serlin was in the military, you know, his father had passed away.
Right.
And he was not able to come home for the funeral. So when Serlin wrote Walking Distance, this is just my own personal opinion, it was kind of a way to get those emotions and those feelings out, you know, to have that last confrontation with your dad, to tell your dad something's not right, looking for your dad's advice for something, like I said, there's a great scene in Walking Distance where Martin Sloan is talking to his father. And Martin says, you know, that he wanted to go back to this simpler time. He didn't want to live in the present. He just wanted to live in the past. And his father told him, well, you know what? The problem is you're looking in the past, try looking ahead. You know, and if you think about that statement, that's very profound. Because how many times do a lot of us live in the past? We don't think about the future, and the past is gone, and all we have is the future. So, like I said, that was a very profound statement in that episode. So,
yeah. Gary, that reminds me of Changing of the Guard that aired last night on MeTV, and it's dealing more with the afterlife than directly, you know, God or the devil. It is looking at good deeds and moving forward in your life. And when you get, you know, just you encounter different stages. And Professor Ellis had a lot of difficulty accepting, you know, the retirement, forced retirement stage. But he really was, you know, looking backwards to move forward.
Right. Well, you know, like I just got to thinking about, like, in that particular episode, you know, because after so many years he was being forced to retire, he kind of took it upon himself that all the years he had been teaching was wasted, which it wasn't. because also in that episode is, you know, the students that are approaching him, telling him, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have learned this. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have learned that, which I think is kind of interesting because I know it's a Christmas time movie, but I was watching It's a Wonderful Life the other day, and it kind of reminded me of the scene where Jimmy Stewart is telling Clarence, he says, you know, when a man is gone, it leaves a horrible hole because each man touches another person's life, whether you want to believe it or not, which was, you know, kind of comparing that movie to the Changing of the Guard episode that, you know, Professor Fowler didn't think he had changed people's lives, but he did. You know, it's just that sometimes we don't look and see, you know, all the positive things we've done in our lives, you know, that have caused positive changes in other people's lives. So,
yeah, Ryan, what drew you into becoming a Twilight Zone aficionado?
Well, you know, memory serves, I think I was like 8 years old when I saw my first episode of The Twilight Zone, and it was out of WGN from Chicago, and it was the season one, The Hitchhiker, and I was really on a, I was like a true monster kid when I was growing up, and in a good sense where, you know, I loved, you know, the old Universal monster movies and 50s sci-fi and stuff like that, and so Twilight Zone just was right up my alley, and so I enjoyed it on a superficial level, really, at first, you know, and as I got older and sort of became more savvy to what was going on in the world of film, I realized, you know, and I think other people have pointed this out, you know, what Serlin was doing with The Twilight Zone were these kind of little mini film noirs, you know, the use of shadow in the cinematography, it's so beautiful and never to be topped. I've never seen anything so beautiful before or since. As I got older, you know, I appreciated it on different levels, but just certainly Serlin's ability to get in there, tell a really crackling story in like 25, 26 minutes, and just really knock our socks off. And I, you know, even the worst episode of The Twilight Zone is better than probably about 100% of the best shows that are out there right now, you know? As Gary said, Twilight Zone and Serlin, they're just evergreens. They really are.
Yeah, Gary, when you're writing about you know, the spirituality of all the episodes, you have to have something in there about the Howling Man or the one with Sebastian Cabot.
Most certainly. And like I said, there are there's one section in there that just deals with what you were just talking about now. You know, there is an excellent episode also called Escape Clause.
Okay.
Which is a guy that decides that he's going to sell his soul for immortality, and I'm not gonna spoil the ending, but it's one of those stories that be careful what you wish for, it might come true. And then of course there's another excellent episode with the devil, not just the Howling Man, but another excellent episode by the talented Burgess Meredith called Printer's Devil. There is another great episode that has Julie Newmar, and from a story called As of Late, I Think of Cliffordville, which was based on another short story. I can't even think of his name right now. I'm having one of those moments.
With Jack Finney or?
No. Albert Salmi. Albert Salmi and Julie Newmar.
Right.
And Albert Salmi plays this guy who is a really rich businessman, but he longs to go back, and he's acquired everything that he could acquire, but he's willing to trade it all to go back and start at the very beginning. But like I said, without giving away the episode, that's another great one to check out.
Of late, I think of Cliffordville.
As of late, I think of Cliffordville. So, like I said, I could expound upon that episode a little bit more, but, you know, it's you get a little bit older and your memory's not what you think it was, and you wish to go back and do something that you did before, but you've forgotten about what things were really like. And you don't necessarily get the result that you're looking for. If anything, you get the exact opposite result.
Yeah, I don't feel badly about that. I forgot the title, too. Thanks, Nick, for your great Rod Serling biography. I had it sitting here next to me just in case.
I needed a
prompt. We have a few episodes as well where Rod and Richard Matheson, crew of very talented writers, also created an afterlife, The Hunt, the pool game with Jack Klugman. I just set the book down and I forgot that episode. But what are how does Rod portray some of these afterlife type episodes? What can we conclude from them?
Well, I think if you were to ask a lot of people, you know, when you say, what's the first thing you think of when you think of heaven? They'll say, well, sitting on a cloud all day and playing on a harp. Or you ask them, well, what about hell? Well, hell is wearing this red suit and carrying a pitchfork and there's flames all around you. But, in the Twilight Zone and in, a couple of Rod's stories, hell could be something that we could create. You know, it may not be a physical place, more of a place or something that you create. You know, I just was thinking of a great Rod Serling quote that says, you know, that man was put on this earth to live once. I know this isn't the exact quote, but he says it's the prerogative of each man and woman to create their own heaven or create their own hell, which there's a lot of truth in that. You know, like I said, without giving any spoilers away, you know, there's a great episode with Sebastian Cabot, A Nice Place to Visit. You know, usually I'm the first person to say that I saw the ending coming. I didn't see the ending coming on that one, but that was a real great ending. For one of your listeners that have not seen that episode, the one with Julie Newmar, I kind of thought it was going to end the way it did, and it did. So, but
but they're all great episodes. It's, but basically, the episodes about hell is something that we personally create, you know, by our actions or inaction or something like that. So.
Okay. We have about 10 minutes left. Ryan, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm kind of just more of a hobbyist now, I guess you'd say, when it comes to Buddy Holly and the Winter Dance Party. I still kind of keep tabs on the whole thing, but right now I'm actually deep in the process of writing a new book. It's called The Fight for Dogfight, River Phoenix, Lily Taylor, Seattle, and the Making of an American Classic. It's a little making-of book of a great little film that came out in 1990 called Dogfight, which starred River Phoenix, the late actor. And so I've been deeply admired in that for the last several years, kind of doing what I did with Buddy Holly in the Winter Dance Party, which is just going around and interviewing as many of the cast and crew and people who were living in Seattle where Dogfight was shot at the time and who may have memories of seeing the movie being shot in their area of town. So that's what I've been losing myself in lately.
Okay, for your In Flanders Field, you interviewed, trilogy on the Winter Dance Party. You've interviewed hundreds of. People to put your publications together.
I was very blessed to talk to everyone that I talked to, and a lot of a lot of those people that I interviewed some time back, they're no longer with us. So I feel very blessed and privileged to have recorded as many stories. I think I sort of compared it at one point to sort of a race against time. You know, when I started these books, I was kind of very wet behind the ears. I didn't really know what I was going to write about, but I knew that history is kind of made up of our collective thoughts and memories, and I knew that every day these people were dying off, and so many people that I didn't get a chance to interview because I started my book so late in the game, which I kick myself for now. I was very blessed to speak to so many of the former teenagers who attended those shows back in 59 and, some of the, the so-called insiders who whether they be like ballroom owners or people who worked at airports or what have you. I was very fortunate to, and a lot of luck and, a lot of help from a lot of different people. These books didn't, I wish I could say I did it all myself, and I certainly did not. Just so many people who allowed me their time and so many people who helped me out along the way. There's so many names, and Gary's one of them, and I was just very blessed to have done what I did.
Well, and just to, once again, to piggyback on something Ryan said, and I've told him this a million times, is not only are those books, they're historical documents, and those are very important because, it definitely paints a picture of gives us a more complete picture of an era that's gone, and kind of like Ryan was saying, once those people are gone, their stories are gone with them. So, I really feel blessed that he was able to get those interviews with those people to actually document them and then get them out in book format to people, so that there will be future generations, long after we're gone, that'll be able to pick up those books and say, hey, what happened in Green Bay, thanks to Ryan's books, they'll be able to do that.
Well, and if I could just give a little shout out real fast, none of those books would have ever happened, for better or for worse, for what they are. None of those books would have happened if it weren't for the very kind help of a gentleman named Bill Griggs, who used to run the Buddy Holly Memorial Society here in the States, and a real mensch and a real welcoming force to newcomers in the Buddy Holly community. Very, very missed now more than ever. He bent over backwards, and he just really helped me out. He really inspired me, and he got me off my keister and got me to, you know, write these books. And a very, very nice gentleman.
And also I'd like to say that with the, especially with the Cricket Six Decades of Rock and Roll Memories, that book would have never, ever seen the light of day unless it would have, you know, without Tony Warren, Peter Fraser Dunnett, and Peter Gibson, all from the UK. You know, we all worked as a team to get that book out. With, and like I said, it was definitely a group effort on that, too. So I want to thank those gentlemen, too.
If I could throw in one more name, Kevin Terry is right up there with Bill Griggs. I think he's the undisputed champ of everything regarding that plane crash. Is certainly a wonderful natural resource and a really wonderful friend to me when I was writing those books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll revisit that topic later. But the winter dance party later, you know, we're coming down to the end, and you know, this is a really fascinating look at a more recent history of the evolution of pop culture. You know, a lot of our shows are going back to Atlantis or you know, medieval times or something like that. But you two made this a really interesting show where, you know, we're still impacted by their legacies. Some people may have remembered watching these episodes or hearing Buddy's songs when they first came out. So, you know, I think this was just a fantastic night of nostalgia and kicking around how so many of these people have continued to influence us today in such a good way. So, you know, those websites, again, if you want to get more information about the concert, 85th birthday concert this weekend, that was at buddyhollyhall.com, and the Serling Fest is August 12th and 13th. And you can go to rodserling.com and get a little bit more information there. We have about 2 minutes left. What's the best way that people can find both your books? Ryan, you want to start off?
Yeah, sure. In Flanders Field, Curious Death and Rebirth of Buddy Holly. Very pretentious title. Don't mind it. I was a little younger. That's available on Amazon Prime, or Amazon, just Amazon. You can just go on there. My other three books, sadly out of print, but one day I'll probably, you know, try and do something as far as getting another print and going. Probably not in the near future. I'm so busy right now with this River Phoenix book.
Okay. And Gary, how about you?
Well, this is going to be real simple. Amazon U.S. or Amazon U.K.
All right.
Okay, so we got through
about an hour and 59 minutes. We're down to a few seconds. I just want to thank Gary and Ryan again. Thank you, Barbara, for producing this. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And we've got a whole bunch of stuff coming up this week. Keep checking Barbara's website, and we'll keep you informed all week. Thank you. See everyone soon.